This is Ahval Online, meeting point of accurate news and free comment on the current affairs of Turkey. Welcome to our podcast series.
Hello, and welcome to Talking Turkey. I'm your host, Ahval editor David Lopeska, and with me today is Tarek Megirisi, a policy fellow with the Middle East and North Africa program at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Hello, Tarek, and thanks for joining us.
Hi, David. Thank you for having me.
You are very welcome. We are speaking on Thursday, July 16, 2 days after U.S. President Donald Trump and Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan discussed the Libya conflict over the phone and agreed, at least according to Turkey, to cooperate more closely to promote stability and find a solution in Libya. But Turkey doesn't exactly seem to me to be promoting stability in Libya. Before we dig into all this, Tarek, let me please give our listeners a bit of background and feel free to correct me afterwards if I get anything wrong. So since 2015, two rival factions and governments in the East and West have been battling for control of Libya. Turkey and Qatar support the Tripoli-based government of National Accord, or GNA, headed by Prime Minister Fayez al-Sarraj, which is fighting the Libyan National Army, led by General Khalifa Haftar, who is backed by the UAE, France, and Russia, and increasingly of late, Egypt. In April 2019, Haftar launched a major push to take Tripoli and made significant gains. Then, late last year, Turkey signed a military cooperation deal as well as a maritime borders deal with the GNA and began dispatching Turkish military advisors, thousands of Syrian rebels, and major weaponry, including advanced drones and air defense systems. This soon turned the tide, and Haftar's forces have in recent months fallen back from Tripoli as Turkey-backed GNA forces have advanced eastward. Yet, instead of propelling the war toward a resolution, this seems to have made an already complex situation even more tense and complicated. Russia has beefed up its support for Haftar, and now Egypt is vowing to intervene if Turkey and the GNA attack Sirte. On the other side, Turkey has invested so much in the GNA that it feels it needs to be able to impose its terms on any resolution to ensure the GNA stays in power. And to do that, it feels like it needs to further weaken Haftar. And the best way it believes it can achieve that is to take Sirte. Tarek, is Libya's civil war about to intensify yet again, or could one hope that this is all just a very winding path to a resolution?
Yeah, I think those of us who have been closely invested in the Libyan conflict for the last few years are always finding ourselves hoping. But it does seem that things are heating up once again. And everything is moving towards a massive escalation, as you said, around the city of Sirte. But also there's a kind of a crucial air base a couple of hundred kilometers south of Sirte, which is called Jufra. And these two locations and the kind of axis between them is likely to be the next battleground. And because it's not Tripoli, because there aren't so many civilians, and because it's a conflict that most people around the world do prefer to ignore, it's unfortunate, but it seems like this even more brutal and destructive iteration of the conflict is going to go by largely unheeded from outside.
France has not been ignoring it. France has been loudly denouncing Turkey's role in Libya since a June 10 maritime incident in which a Turkish warship thought to be carrying arms to Libya refused to allow a French frigate to carry out mandatory inspections as part of a NATO and United Nations arms embargo. France says the Turkish vessel's targeting technology locked in on the French ship, while Turkey denies any wrongdoing. French President Emmanuel Macron said Ankara's actions were criminal and put European security at risk. But France's EU partners, particularly Italy, which has significant economic interests in Libya, have offered little sympathy. But on Wednesday, yesterday, the United States backed the French view. And again, this came a day after Trump and Erdogan had reportedly vowed to cooperate more closely on Libya. So what's going on here, Tariq? Is the U.S. playing both sides, or does Trump maybe not have any Libya policy at all?
Yeah, I think, you know, in this world, we never have absolutes, but it's certainly closer to the latter than the former. You know, with these kind of incidences, what happened on the high seas, you've always got two sides to a story. And I think what's interesting is what's been reported so far of NATO's internal investigation is that the French vessel kind of provoked a reaction from their Turkish counterparts. And that's not to say that it wasn't almost certainly transporting weapons to Libya in contravention of the Security Council embargo. But it just shows that this is more of a distraction than an attempt at resolving seriously the issues in Libya. You know, France, after the failure of their guy in Libya, Khalifa Haftar, they're trying to focus on Turkey as the kind of the font of all problems and all destabilization in the country for numerous kind of political and foreign policy reasons. And it's part of a wider disagreement with Turkey that extends far beyond Libya. From the US perspective, you just have this problem whereby, you know, the White House is doing its own thing. They seem to have a president this time around who's happy telling Erdogan, Mohammed bin Zayed, Macron, basically whoever he's speaking to, that, you know, he's happy to work with them and he fully adopts their view. But if you trickle down a bit more, you know, you do have more nuanced positions from the State Department, which really just seems hell-bent on de-escalating no matter what. But then you also have the military components, you know, the Department of Defense and Africa Command, who for a couple of months now have seemed to be quietly egging on Turkey. And I think that these reports that Russia is kind of trying to hold on to Sirte, to embed in the airbase or Sirte's airport and naval port, has really stirred up some serious concerns in amongst the US military types. And that gives Turkey kind of a second wind. It gives them this impression that, you know, they can tell the rest of the NATO alliance that they're doing their dirty work because they're going to stop Russia kind of embedding in Sirte and being able to impose or influence what happens in NATO air bases in Sicily, or just to remove that Russian presence from the central Mediterranean.
Mm-hmm. Right. But back to Turkey and Egypt, whose leaders both have friendly relations with Trump, but certainly not with each other, mainly because of Turkey's backing for the Muslim Brotherhood and Egypt's Brotherhood president, Mohamed Morsi, who was ousted in a very bloody coup led by Sisi in 2013. On Tuesday, Haftar's LNA gave Sisi the go-ahead to intervene in its defense, while Turkish Air Force cargo planes just today began arriving at Libya's Awatiya base, which tells us Turkey seems to still be beefing up its military presence. Cairo is said to fear that a permanent Turkey-backed government in Libya would create a Muslim Brotherhood hub that will then seek to undermine the Sisi regime through activism and possibly terror attacks. It seems like both sides have taken very firm positions. How do you see this playing out, particularly around Sirte? Will these two regional rivals and U.S. allies go to war in Libya?
You know, it's always difficult to gaze into the crystal ball, but it seems like an increasingly likely scenario. Because as you say, you know, as you've laid out quite well, each side is operating from a zero-sum perspective. There are certain pillars to their policy that they can't afford to give up. And, you know, this whole Haftar assault on Tripoli was kind of an all-or-nothing affair. And now that it collapsed into nothing, those who supported him are trying to gather up the pieces and recreate something from it. So, you know, from the Egyptian perspective, they they understand that they need something more to barter with or to protect their interests in the country. And even if it's not going to be Haftar, it has to be this this institution of the Libyan Arab Armed Forces or another kind of local proxy, be it Aguila Saleh, the Speaker of the Parliament, Libya's last elected institution, but some kind of conduit. And there needs to be some kind of cohesive entity for it to back. And it seems that if CERT falls, if the government forces and Turkish-backed forces, or however we're going to call them, move even further east, then any hopes of having like a local Libyan entity that they can use to barter off the Turkish in the Tripoli position is just going to be lost. And so it seems that in that moment of desperation, just as how, you know, Egyptian and Emirati and French backing for Haftar pushed Turkey to intervene, it seems that Turkey and Tripoli's government turning the screw might give the Egyptians the thought that they have no choice but to intervene. But, you know, interventions can be very tricky. A sustained intervention in a country like Libya, even more so. And when there is no clear kind of strategic outcome, there are a lot of questions around, you know, what any Egyptian intervention will look like. And although the politicians might talk big, I have a feeling that, you know, the generals in Cairo are growing a lot of new white hairs over this intervention before it's even happened. So I think that if it does happen, it will be something that's more for show than for a practical outcome. You know, perhaps a deployment in eastern Libya that allows other forces to push further west, or just overtly claimed airstrikes, overtly claimed weapons deliveries, things like that. I think we'd have to go a long way to see, you know, Egyptian armored formations and infantry battalions fighting it out with their Turkish counterparts.
Okay, but still, you say something sounds likely, some sort of conflict between Turkey and Egypt over Sirte or over areas further to the east. I wonder if you think there's anything that other powers, the US, the EU, even Russia or the UAE, might do to stop it. Or do they, to some extent, want this to happen and maybe take some advantage from it?
I mean, it depends where you go. You know, you could make quite a good case to say that at the end of the day, Cairo is just negotiating with what it's doing. There have been back channel talks between them and Ankara over the Eastern Mediterranean issue, over the Libyan issue. But, you know, if you go a bit further east to Abu Dhabi, then there is certainly no room for negotiation there. They want Turkey out. They want to make this intervention as difficult and costly as possible for them. It seems that Russia has a very similar perspective to Egypt, whereby it needs to maintain an entity in Libya that it can use to barter against the Turks. And it's already, you know, Russian mercenaries and jets that are holding the line in Sirte and that are planning the defenses. So I don't think we're going to see any de-escalatory talk from that side. The United States seems to be too divided, as we already discussed, and, you know, right at the very top in the White House, I don't think they really care much for Libya, especially given how much of a stick Libya was for President Trump to use against Hillary Clinton in the last election, and that this now is an election year. And so that just leaves the Europeans. And, you know, we've already talked about some European divisions at play. France has always heavily backed Haftar, has been in the same camp as Abu Dhabi, and the other involved states, the Germans, the Italians, they always saw this whole Haftar enterprise, the war, as something that would always be more destabilizing than stabilizing. And now it's a question of, do they really want to put the political capital on the table to try to force a deal, or are they going to continue trying to convene, and not really guide things in any particular direction?
Right. You wrote a Libya analysis report for ECFR in June 2019, arguing that Haftar's advance, which was happening then, had been launched, I guess, a couple months before, it could spark escalation and greater instability, potentially increasing terrorism and people smuggling, and that this meant the EU had a stronger interest to get involved and to pressure foreign backers of Haftar to de-escalate. Of course, here we are more than a year later, and Europe has barely lifted a finger, and France, as you say, has continued to back Abu Dhabi in its support of Haftar, though that support has apparently seemed to decline or kind of waver in recent months. But so I wonder, to what extent do you think Europe has failed Libya, starting with the early days of the conflict and perhaps particularly the past year? Most observers seem to take one of three positions. They either blame Turkey and Qatar, or the UAE and Saudi Arabia, and maybe France, and then Europe and a little bit the US. For you, it seems to be mostly Europe.
I mean, we live in a world of absolutes, and the Libyan crisis and its devolution has a lot of fathers, you know. I wouldn't put blame entirely on anybody's shoulders, but you know, if we want to talk about themes instead, like what caused Libya to devolve the way it has, it's partially because it was never taken as seriously as it should have been by the likes of Europe and the United States, and partially because you have middle powers like the UAE and Egypt who believed that they were more savvy and capable at controlling another country's future than they actually were. And if we're going to talk about the former, which is primarily Europe's problem here, it's still very much in play. You know, we do have an increasingly geopolitical Europe. I mean, they've called their new commission the Geopolitical Commission, and we see that Libya is high up there. But how does that translate into action? I mean, we still have very few member states out of the 27 who really could give two thoughts to Libya. Out of those three, we have the Germans, who have put together the Berlin process and who are still trying to convene all of the interventionists, but still don't place Libya as important enough to try to coerce the interventionists into any particular behavior. You have the Italians, who have two modes. Either they work bilaterally with their partners to secure interests, or they take a step back, as they did in 2019 as the war was ongoing. And then you have France, which is very firmly partisan in a heavily divided landscape. And that's not kind of fertile ground for a resolution to come from. I mean, the ingredients are there, but there's nobody who's kind of cooked them up together to create a European policy for Libya, something that can really drive progress on the ground. Me and my eternal hope, you know, I do see the ingredients starting to move a bit closer together. We have a German presidency of the EU. We have, because of Turkey, because of the East Med, because of other issues, we do have more and more discussions about Libya happening at an EU level, happening at a ministerial level. So perhaps things will change going forward, but you know, as ever, time is the enemy.
You mentioned what's happening on the ground right now. In an Aval article published yesterday, journalist Lindsay Snell detailed how the people of Sirte have begun to fear the return of Turkey-backed extremist militants who apparently harassed, randomly arrested, and stole from locals after taking control of the city from ISIS in late 2016. Their control lasted until last year's arrival of Haftar's LNA, which locals told Snell had begun to rebuild the city. I wonder what you think of this, Tarek. Does this align with what you've heard about Sirte and how various forces controlled it?
I mean, this is just narrative building. You know, every side likes to paint themselves as the builders and the statesmen of Libya, and the others as criminal entities. But, you know, if we look at what happened on the ground, the primary force for Sirte's internal security since the Misratin-led alliance kind of liberated the city from ISIS, has been the 604th Brigade, a largely Salafist brigade who many non-religious types would define as extremist in their own way, who were trained in Tripoli and who were part of that kind of liberation force. The only thing that changed when Haftar's forces moved in is that the 604th Brigade, you know, flipped their allegiance. So it's essentially the same group, by and large, who are responsible for Sirte's internal security here. Going forward, I mean, I'm sure that I'm sure that there are fears amongst most of the civilians about what the future will bring. This is a period of war. And Sirte has held that title of being Muammar Gaddafi's hometown as a very heavy burden since 2011. Its relationship with Misrata, its relationship with revolutionary forces after the war was extremely hostile and tense, for want of better terms. And that, things don't happen in a vacuum. It was the way that Sirte was treated after 2011 that eased the path for ISIS to come in. It was the way that Sirte was used as kind of a political bargaining chip, both by Haftar and by the Misratans and the GNA side before finally making a move for it in 2015, that has given it the storied and troubled history that it has done. So I wouldn't say that, I wouldn't engage in the partisanship or in the narrative building here. I would just say that the war is going to be horrible, no matter what comes, especially given these reports of booby trapping that's going on in the neighborhoods.
Right. That Snell article also detailed Turkey's problematic treatment of the thousands of Syrian rebels Ankara has brought to Libya first. Many have been paid, the article said, significantly less than Turkey promised them, and as a result have turned to stealing and looting. And second, while Turkish officers stay in cozy offices on Libyan military bases, the Syrian rebels are the ones sent out to do all the fighting and dying. I wonder if you've heard similar things and whether this might begin to erode morale among the Syrian fighters on the GNA side and undermine any potential upcoming assault.
I mean, I can't talk much for the morale within the kind of Syrian Turkish camp. There are a lot of Syrians in Libya now. There were a lot of mercenaries in general. I did hear reports that Syrians had taken casualties or quite heavy casualties towards the end of the assault on Tripoli. The one kind of first-hand report from Tripoli at that time, published by Fred Weary, indicated that there are Turkish officers there in close contact or in constant whatever in constant presence with the Syrian forces there. But it's not kind of a Syrian-led and managed war. It's still primarily a Libyan affair. It's still primarily Libyans that are dying and Libyans that are going to die if the war for Sirte kicks off. Whether Turkey is able to sustain its deals with the Syrians going forward, I think is going to be more of a Turkish problem than a Libyan problem. And from the GNA side, it was made quite clear that the Libyan forces, A, wanted to ensure that these rumors that the Syrians that were bought over had extremist elements were untrue before allowing them in the front and allowing them near to Libyan positions, because as you'll recall, it was these same Misratans who fought ISIS in the first place, who are now fighting with, who are now the main fighting force of the GNA side. And yeah, going forward, it's not the GNA's army is not a Syrian army. It's still by and large, a Libyan army. So it's, yeah, I think perhaps we're giving it more attention than it's due.
Okay. Oh, because on the other side, there have been reports that Russia and Assad have been seeking out Syrian mercenaries, and much like Turkey on the other side, dispatching them to fight in Libya for Haftar. My first response to this, which you just addressed, was that it underscores just how bizarre and complex the Libyan war has become, that it might be decided, at least in part, by Syrian fighters on both sides. But Dark, how many of these Syrian mercenaries, do you think Russia and Assad have sent to support Haftar, to fight on Haftar's side? Could it be enough to alter the war in any way? And secondly, how true are Turkey's accusations that these Syrian fighters are supposed war criminals?
Yeah, it's look at the accusations of Russian Syrians are that they're war criminals or they're XYZ, and then at the same time, those who are supporting Haftar accuse accuse Turkey Syrians of being jihadists or of being ABC. It shows you the kind of ridiculousness of the situation that we've got it in. I mean, we're already in a fundamentally bizarre place when we have the Syrian civil war taking place on Libyan shores and a part of the Libyan civil war. And, you know, the Syrians are not the first foreign mercenaries to be used in Libya. And if, you know, sometimes with a situation as complex as Libya, it's best to talk about trends or dynamics rather than one-off events. And to say that this trend of more and more mercenaries being pumped in, you know, you've got at least a couple of thousand Syrians who will be coming in thanks to the Russians. You have over 1,000 Sudanese from various different camps who have been documented in UN reports for years who are fighting. You have Chadian militias. And it's increasingly, you know, it's a very dangerous dynamic. And the fact that it keeps exacerbating, it keeps getting worse, I think does not augur well for the future of the Libyan conflict. And, you know, there's quite a funny dynamic, or funny is probably the worst term to use, but it's another strange development that with every iteration of the war, the force driving the war is more and more international and less Libyan. So the more mercenaries that come into the country, the more this kind of internationalization and this proxy war facet becomes stronger than the civil war dynamic that was taking place before. And that's something that we should really watch out for going forwards.
Yeah, I mean, that's not so different from how you concluded that ECFR article last year. I mentioned before that you wrote last year. You said, given the UN's paralysis, the impetus for a new approach should come from Europe. Unless there is an end to destructive external interventions in Libya, any political process in the country will fail. Again, here we are a year later. Europe has done very little and seems to be bickering internally about Libya. Turkey continues to increase its support for one side, while Russia and Syria boost their backing of the other. I mean, Russia and the UAE and Syria. And now Egypt is talking about joining the party with a ground offensive. Do you think Libya right now is maybe as far from resolution as it's been in a number of years? And how do we start moving towards that? What might happen now to put us in that direction?
Yeah, I mean, I think the last couple of weeks has shown that that the kind of collapse of Haftar's assault, the collapse of the Libyan Arab armed forces is this kind of functional facade for an army, you know, something that you could pass off as being an army, would allow the country to move forward, has been well and truly dashed. And I suppose it's going to be the next couple of weeks that show us whether we're just going to be pushed into a civil war or to another bigger conflict, or if, you know, we will be able to snatch some kind of resolution from the jaws of conflict. It's certainly become more difficult to find where the resolution comes from because of how much more invested every country is. So, you know, Turkey was involved in Libya in 2015 and 16, but nowhere near the same scale as it is today. Similarly, since 2015, the UAE has invested the amount of armaments, mercenaries, and so on that probably goes into the billions of dollars. And you know, when you, if you're, sometimes when you put too much on the table, it becomes very hard to back down. Even if you're bluffing, you feel the need to continue to commit to your bluff and to commit to your position.
And even when you start losing.
Exactly. And so it means that it becomes much harder to draw a clean line from where we are today towards a resolution. And I think that we have glimpses of opportunities, and unless we are in a position to take them, which we're not, then they just fly by. And the perfect example of that is what I was trying to say happened over the last few weeks. You know, you had the collapse of Haftar, you had all of his backers sitting there waiting, expecting to be kind of pushed beyond this paradigm of saying, okay, you know, your dreams for putting this kind of strongman and power are over. Let's all move together towards something more functional. That this message was going to come from Europe and the USA, and then it never came. And then when the kind of first tentative testing of the waters started with this Cairo proposal, whereby, you know, President Sisi put out the statement that still pretended like the Libyan Arab Armed Forces is the center of any peace deal to be made, and, you know, to put forward the talk of a ceasefire whereby the only precondition is that the government forces that have just beaten Haftar's forces should surrender all of their weapons. When that was taken, you know, completely uncritically by Europeans, and they released a statement congratulating the Egyptians and praising their peacemaking efforts, then I think everybody was back on more comfortable territory. You know, they knew that even though the Haftar dream might be over, they can still salvage this Eastern entity. They can still salvage this ongoing civil war, and this dichotomy continued. And as long as we live in this dichotomy, as long as we keep believing that it's either got to be the Eastern forces with whichever face the Egyptians want to put on it next, or it's going to be the government of national accord in Tripoli, then Libya will continue to be in a state of conflict. It's going to take a real piece of bravery from someone to say, look, let's just move beyond this. You know, the UN put out there this national conference idea, this idea of moving beyond this kind of these broken institutions that were created in 2015. And instead of being backed, they were undermined by everybody involved in Libya. And so it's going to take real bravery to put that idea back on the table. And it's going to take a lot of diplomatic effort to kind of corral all of the intervening states to say, you know, even if you're not going to support it, you're not going to do anything to completely subvert and undermine it, such as launching an attack on the capital 10 days before this conference is going to take place. You know, we need to create a dynamic as we had in 2015, whereby most of the, or at least all of the Western states were pulling in the same direction. But given how much the world has changed, you know, given how broken the Security Council is, how disinterested DC is, this burden is going to fall on European shoulders. And whilst they have all the interest in the world to be pulling in this direction, whether Libya in European eyes will become important enough to barter against their Egyptian relationships, to barter against their Gulf relationships or their Turkish relationships, that's probably going to be the million-dollar question here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you said there needs to be some bravery, but we haven't really seen bravery on the part of like the main interveners in Libya, Turkey, the UAE, or Egypt. It seemed to all be acting on their own, you know, national interests. And what do you think might move? And as you say, the U.S. seems to be in another world entirely, mostly because it's dealing with both the pandemic and the upcoming presidential election. But what might do you think drive the EU to get more involved, to be more diplomatically aggressive? I mean, the number of migrants I see and refugees has increased on Sicily and Lampedusa in recent months, and some of them, a good number of them, have had coronavirus. So that seems like a new concern, you know, and Turkey seems to be aggressively taking on French and Italian claims, oil and gas claims in the Eastern Mediterranean, but that doesn't seem to be enough to really get them involved. So what kind of thing do you think would drive them to have a stronger, more aggressive diplomatic approach?
Yeah, you know, Europe is a leviathan of sorts, and it's going to move slowly. So we can see a general trend towards more European interest, you know, and I think So like seeing the Berlin conference take place and the Berlin process, which has happened before and after it, I mean, that's something quite out of the ordinary when it comes to German foreign policy. How often have we seen, you know, that big international conference take place there and this kind of constant back channel efforts to deal with and engage with all the interventionist states? And, you know, this idea that the Berlin process and the meetings that it hosts is still the only forum, I think, probably in the world where you have the Turks and the Emirati sitting on the same table to discuss Libya. And this stuff, it counts for something. It was this kind of really bad analogy that I was trying to put out there before of having all the ingredients, just nobody's cooked them up yet. So we can start to see Europe move towards a resolution. I mean, even on this latest Foreign Affairs Committee meeting, conclusions that came out with it, they didn't bite the French carrot for once. The France has tried to dangle a red flag and get the Europeans to engage more aggressively with Turkey. And the European response was more considered, to say, we're going to try to engage them. We're going to give them a month or so to back down from certain positions. We're going to open up more talks with them. And that suggests that, that we are starting to move towards more of a geopolitical commission, to use their own language. It's just something that's going to happen very slowly. And whether they'll be able to stop mollifying France when it comes to Libya, whether the Italians and the Germans, the Dutch as well, who have, although they're not part of the Berlin process, have taken up kind of the being the chair of the Human Rights and Accountability Working Group of the Berlin process, whether these states can kind of convince the other 24, if my math is correct, that Libya is worth engaging for, worth sticking their neck out for, then yeah, we're going to start to move on from the gathering the ingredients process to the cooking it up process. What do we need to get there? I think we need more European solidarity for one, because European states know that today, if they engage with the Gulf in an aggressive foreign policy way, it usually ends up with that European state being isolated and economically punished. So Europe has to move together on any issue. And it involves being more strategic, of really knowing what Europe wants and how it decides to get there. And I think that would be the huge thing which distinguishes a potential future European foreign policy from European Libya policy today, whereby the Europeans are always following the interventionists, are always mollifying, trying to get them to be happy, whereas what they should be doing is leading them or shepherding them in a particular direction.
We'll see if that greater European involvement happens before this explodes in kind of a Turkey-Egypt war. Tarek Megrisi of the European Council on Foreign Relations, thank you so much for your time and insight. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, David. Pleasure is mine.
You can follow Ahval News online podcast series through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Spreaker. All you need to know about Turkey is here for your ears, mind, and attention. Thank you for listening to our podcast.